This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Fantastic to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Talking health on today's show. Looking at the effect of COVID-19 on cancer patients. And ultimately what the pandemic has done for the number of diagnoses. Not just here in the UAE, but internationally too. We were lucky enough to steal away an hour of time with Dr. Stuart Carr. He is a leading expert when it comes to patients with asthma, pediatric allergies, and immunology as well. And he was talking about food intolerances and allergies, answering some of the questions. Are there actually more, or do we just know about them? And of course, taking your questions too. And we know how many celebrities now fear social media because they fear being cancelled. Talking trolls and cancel culture with Dr. Thryer from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking health this afternoon and COVID-19. I haven't said COVID. We're nearly 10 minutes into the show and it's the first time I've said COVID. That's got to be a world record. It has had so many consequences. One of them, of course, has been the effect on people. And we do forget that even in the time of COVID, there are so many different diagnoses. There's all the illnesses and conditions that just go along day in, day out. And cancer patients are a group of people that have been hugely affected by COVID-19. Cancer diagnoses have actually fallen during the pandemic. This is not a good thing. According to the Journal of Clinical Pathology, it looks at diagnosed rates during 2020 in comparison to 2018 to 2019. There has been a 40% drop in patients diagnosed with cancer globally. And for those already battling the disease, when COVID hit the world, the consequences on treatment, the logistics, can be dire. Irene Clemente joining us now, who's been battling several different types of cancer. Her treatment was stalled because she got COVID-19, making you very vulnerable indeed, Irene. How are you today?
Hi, Helen. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. At the moment, I can say I'm okay. The challenges are still there. I can feel some of those symptoms, but just keep going.
Tell us about your health before you contracted COVID. You were diagnosed with cancer. What kind of cancer was that, and when did you get that diagnosis, Irene?
Yeah, actually, I had cancer since a decade. It started in colon cancer, and then it gets metastasized. It went to my ovarian cancer, and then it went to the liver, and on. So before I got COVID, I had a procedure sometime in December of last year. So it's kind of there are really like challenges, but I guess COVID is much more worse than cancer.
Yes, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. I think it's, you know, we talk about the cancer rates and, you know, number of diagnosis, and we can talk about numbers all we like, but it is honestly, it comes back to people, it comes back to stories, to experiences. And you had a number of surgeries in the UK, Irene, that really saved your life. And as you said, you've been undergoing treatment for years. You were supposed to have radiation treatment a few months ago, but you did.
Absolutely.
You contracted COVID. Tell us about finding out about having COVID-19. How did it come about?
I have said, I had a procedure sometime in December 28th last year, and then after a week I got this COVID. During the first day actually of my COVID, it's kind of like I thought it was just tolerable. So, well, actually the hospital sent me back home and with the medicines. But after 4 days, that's the worst nightmare that I have ever experienced in my life. So name it, all the I can say all the symptoms I had it. So, but the worst is the fatigue. It's a severe fatigue that I cannot even walk by myself. I need to find something to hold on to reach the washroom, and it's only like few steps away from my bed. So after on the fourth day, on the first day I had only fever, and then no appetite. I force myself to eat, but then no appetite, and then like I keep on the LVM was there, so I guess I can like more than 10 I always went to the washroom for more than 10 times because of that. I don't feel like eating or drinking. And then on the third day, I had this flu and then cough. So on the fourth day, the severe chest pain is... I was actually in touch with my doctor, with my oncologist. And then she actually was the one who asked me to call an ambulance. Mm-hmm. On the fourth day, an ambulance picked me up here in my place. And then the rest is history. I don't know what happens next. When I wake up, it's kind of like there's this unforgettable nurse that I cannot really forget. I forgot her name, but I will never forget what he did to me. When I woke up, he told me, like, just keep fighting and don't be those people who just give up.
And having spoken to friends who have been in ICU, and you talk about there about a nurse giving you the strength. So many times we've heard this, that it's COVID is a disease, a condition that happens in the body, but it happens in the mind as well, that you need to be mentally strong and positive to choose to keep fighting. And it sounds, Irene, through everything you've been through, you are a fighter through and through. You are active, you're alive, you're with us today, and you've actually put together a bucket list of things that you want to do. Tell us why you decided to put that together and what's on it.
Yeah, okay. For me, to survive is you have to keep going, because if you stop, then your life is end already. You ended up your life already. You put a dot on your life. So you have to look forward to the things that you... what I put up is like things to look forward to. And then I ended up putting it as a bucket list. I need to get well, because those bucket lists, all the lists on my bucket list, I have to do that. And that's why it's like a great motivator. So it's like a motivating factor for me to keep going and to get well and stand up and continue what I have left.
So what's on the list, Irene? Can you share a few things?
The things that I have done already, first and foremost, is I'm an undergrad. So I finished my college degree, my bachelor's degree in BATSPA, and then I pursue my MBA. I'm taking a master's degree in BATSPA also. And the things, like, I'm taking a master's degree when I got COVID. Wow. It so happened that the BATSPA University is really very generous and motivate me to push through, to continue my studies. A part of having a COVID is the depression. Mm-hmm. I admit it, I really had that. So it's like, oh my gosh, how can I regain my energy? How can I study? How can I work? Even my intellectual is also not functioning. I felt like as if totally mentally blocked. But then the school, the BATSPA University, is really very generous to... I mean, they're really, I can say they're really a great motivating factor for me to continue my studies, because that's my goal. That's actually one... I have a goal in life, so that I have to continue, and that's why that's one of my bucket list. And also, I want to this Mount Everest thing. It's my dream when I was a child.
You are amazing.
The moment I knew that there's a Mount Everest, I keep on pushing myself. Even I know I'm already old, but I know that there's nothing impossible as long as you keep going. So. Another thing is my trekking, Mount Everest trekking.
If anyone can do it, Irene, it's going to be you. Thank you so much for being with us today. Irene, there, a decade of cancer treatment coming through COVID. She's been to Rwanda to build a school for underprivileged children. She's doing her MBA and has her eyes on Mount Everest. Absolutely unbelievable.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Speaking earlier to the incredible Irene, lots of you getting in touch with messages of support for her, who is still battling the disease. It's been a decade. She was diagnosed with colon cancer, and then it's been in her ovaries. And she has not let it hold her back. She's looking to climb Everest. She's currently studying for her MBA. And now we're joined by Navena, who has recovered from breast cancer, and her doctor as well, Dr. Ibrahim Abugaida, who's the head of Department of Radiation Oncology at Bajil Medical City, Abu Dhabi. Thank you both for being with us today. Navena, the pandemic made your job particularly stressful to the point where you took the decision to quit. Can you tell us about what was it like in the run-up to you making that decision? What was going on?
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for inviting me. Well, I think we all suffered or still suffering during the pandemic, but and we do understand the cutting costs, but I have been left alone out of the team of 27 people. So I was handling it as far as I could, but I reached the point when I started really feeling that it's affecting my good health, affecting my family. So I've made not an easy decision after 9.5 years to leave and try to recuperate and then see later where will I be able to pick up. Because honestly, I mean, not being employed for the last 6 months, I'm not a stay-at-home person. I'm really looking forward to get back to daily routine. But like I said, I reached the point where it was my health or staying and working, and I just decided, let me take a break. At that point, I didn't know. I didn't know what was happening. I knew that there is some effect on my health, but I didn't know how big of an effect it had. So,
you took that decision to focus on your health, and as many people do, you know, you have a break from work and you have this to-do list of life admin, health admin, and it's true, you know, even you know, thinking about the school holidays, I'm like, okay, now I can take the kids to the dentist, or you know, now we'll go and get their ears. You know, it's so hard to fit these things in around a busy working life, and
especially when, as I said, you're one instead of 27.
Yeah, you're trying to do the work of 27 people.
Yes.
It's unbelievable. So you go for a health check, and unfortunately, you know, or fortunately, of course, you know, this the cancer is flagged. Tell us about that moment. Did you have any idea that it was going to be this kind of diagnosis?
No, I definitely haven't had any idea. So it was just like, as you said, to-do list. So starting with, let's do this and that. And I went and I did my first mammogram. And I thought it would be just routine, you know, just to check the box so that I can concentrate on recuperation, yoga, meditation, everything else. 3 months of so-called sabbatical and moving on. But on 2nd of January, well, I thought, you know, and I assume that a lot of people had the same thought when 1st of January 2021 came, to like, oh, thank goodness, we're done with 2020.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, on 2nd of January, after a few weeks of waiting, and you know, when you do the checkup and it takes some time, you kind of start assuming that maybe it's not all great, though it was COVID and it was close to the holidays. But when my doctor called me and said, listen, I need to see you, I'm like, oh, God, okay. I still didn't know it's cancer. And 2nd of January in the afternoon, sitting with my doctor, I heard these three words that you just don't want to hear. But I got that you have cancer. And it surprised me, but that moment I decided, okay, whatever it is, we'll deal with that, and we'll find a way to go through this. And I was super phenomenal, extremely lucky to get support of the whole Virgil team, but especially oncology, radiology team. Apparently, it turned out that the new department has been opened recently, and they have contacted me. And my journey started with lumpectomy end of January, and after that, I have met Dr. Ibrahim and his team. They told me, we'll take care of you. And somehow I did believe them, because they always say you need to click with your hairdresser, with your dentist, and with your doctor. And I definitely clicked with Dr. Ibrahim and the rest of his, all of them. Wow. Absolutely phenomenal people.
Let's speak to Dr. Ibrahim. I love this. It's important to click with your hairdresser and your oncologist. Dr. Ibrahim is joining us, Head of Department for Radiation Oncology at Vigil Medical City. Dr. Ibrahim, thank you so much for your time today. You know, Navina had this cancer diagnosis, but in some ways she has been one of the lucky ones to go along for a check. And as I said earlier, cancer diagnosis rates have fallen significantly during the pandemic. But she went for mammogram, she caught it early. The treatment, of course, is the same during COVID, but cancer patients are more vulnerable, need to be protected more. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've seen in clinic? Have you seen a real change in the number of people coming through to get that initial check?
All right. Thank you so much for having us. And thank you, Navina, for this very touchy story. We've been privileged to be part of your team. It's not it's a privilege to take care of cancer patients specifically. And kudos for all your hard work. And hopefully, you know, we're going to celebrate more and more occasions when times goes along. To answer your question, Ellen, I think this is an incredibly good question and an incredibly tough question to address. We have seen waves of patients during the complete lockdowns. Unfortunately, there was a lot of patients that felt something and knew something was not right, but they didn't seek medical attention. And, you know, when things kind of eased up, we've seen a surge in new diagnosis. And unfortunately, some patients, I'll say like breast cancer patients that felt some lumps and kind of neglected those, they came to us a couple of months after those symptoms appeared and they were kind of more of locally advanced. Mm-hmm. And in these scenarios, the treatments, as you know, is more intense. And some of them, you know, we're able to, of course, help and aim for cure. But unfortunately, some of them, the disease has gone beyond the cure, spectrum. So this has caused some delay in diagnosis and early treatment, which is key, as you mentioned, for cancer.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking about undergoing cancer treatment and indeed making sure you get a diagnosis even during the pandemic. Speaking to Navina, who recently recovered from breast cancer, and her doctor, Dr. Ibrahim Abugaida, he's the head of Department of the Radiation Oncology Bajil Medical City in Abu Dhabi. Navina did quit her job due to stress during the pandemic when her team was reduced from 27 people to just her. And during that time when she was off work, she went for mammogram and discovered that she had breast cancer. Dr. Ibrahim, a message here, no name on this one, and we know when it comes to health it can be sensitive, so don't feel like you have to put your name on if you'd rather not. A message saying, I'm 42 and every year I do a breast ultrasound, never done a mammogram, is it needed as well? What would you say to a 42-year-old woman who's considering having a mammogram?
Thank you so much for this question. It really depends. First of all, she needs to see her primary care physician. Mammography is an excellent study, but sometimes with women with dense breasts, mammography might be suboptimal, and we kind of complement this with an ultrasound. So it really depends on the woman's density of breast density. That will be the best modality, of course, and the family history as well is very important. So it all depends. It starts with a consultation, physical examination, and then determining the best modality way of screening.
And a message from Kat saying, thank you for this. I'm new to Dubai. Are there any general health checks or screenings you can have to look for lumps, bumps or abnormalities rather than seeing a specific doctor for a specific concern? Thank you for that, Kat. Again, a really good question. And I'm sure you do too. My dad's had cancer 3 times. And I think anyone who's got that family history just dreams of a time where, a bit like in the Jetsons, you walk into some kind of like a spray tan booth and it just screens you for cancer from head to toe. And hopefully doesn't find anything, but if it does, it just goes, it's here, and off you go as a very early detection to the particular doctor. But we are here in 2021, and Kat's question about a general screening rather than going to see a specific doctor about a specific lump or bump, what would you recommend?
So thank you. We get asked this a lot. Actually, my own parents asked me this as well. So unfortunately, there is no there's no approved general screening for all cancers, right? So there are some approved screening programs, for example, for breast cancer, for colorectal cancer, for lung cancer in smokers, and for prostate cancers in men. So, however, it's very important that, annual checkup with your general practitioner is extremely important, and people kind of underestimate how important that is. Mm-hmm. And kind of going into the detail of, you know, sometimes we do need some more kind of keep a vigilant eye in some patients who have high risk factors of developing cancer, high significant family history of cancers. In these patients, sometimes we might need to do some thorough examination, more thorough screening. But in general, there is no test currently approved for all cancers, because you got to keep in mind any test comes with its own costs and its own stress on the patient. There is a lot of tests that are being done that shows a false positive things, and then the patients are in stress and ended up needing to do some procedures that are kind of probably not necessary. So we always try to do what's necessary, what's needed for the patient, not because we want to save money, no, it's just because we want to save unnecessary tests that might cause some stress on the patient himself or herself as well.
For UCA, I had the kind of executive women's test a couple of weeks ago, and it was about 3 hours out of my day. And it was blood screenings. I had breast, abdominal, pelvic ultrasound, and some X-rays done as well. And it was 3 hours. And my big kind of takeaway, apart from the fact that I've got the metabolic age of a 24-year-old, but the knees of an 84-year-old, was that prevention is just so much better than cure. And I kind of walked away going, right, that was 3 hours that I'm never going to get back. But I've got reassurances that blood work is healthy. I need to work on my iron levels. I need to get this physio done on my knee. But at least information is power, I think, a lot of the time. So if everyone is on top of those regular screenings, it can save an awful lot of heartache and treatment, certainly down the road. Dr. Ibrahim, I wanted to really acknowledge the fact that in so many ways we are so lucky here in the UAE, because we've got facilities that in other parts of the world, they're having to reallocate resources to tackle COVID. What would you say to anyone who perhaps might be postponing some of those essential checks because of fear of the pandemic?
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. I mean, we are definitely lucky by having access to effective vaccines, having very good manpower and very good strategic planning in order to maintain life as much as regular as possible. And I think we are one of the first countries to adapt to, I hate to call it the new normal, but for the time being, it seems like, you know, we are kind of adapting to a new way of living. And people are getting more used to it. And the most important thing is that the access for screening tools have never been depleted. So the mammographies are there, the hospitals are there, the doctors are there, mm-hmm. willing to do the screening for the patients. And all it needs is the patient's own will to take the first step and to go see their physician. And this is, I think, where our job as educators, as patient proponents, is to educate them and encourage them in doing so.
I'd like to ask you, Navina, a little bit about your fears about treatment during the pandemic as well. You know, you obviously went in for your health check, but then the thought of going into a hospital on a regular basis for your cancer treatment must have been quite intimidating. How did you feel about that prospect?
To be honest with you, at the first meeting with Dr. Ibrahim, I have been briefed how the whole treatment will look and what if it happens that I get positive or start something, that the treatment will continue. So we did cover that at our first meeting before we even started. Dr. Ibrahim can confirm, but the first question that I had for him was, will I be able to get my vaccine? Because obviously before the surgery, it wasn't possible, but as soon as I could, I have got it. And overall, just the feel was that everything has been thoroughly thought of, that everything is already put in the procedures that there is no, you know, what is spending.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point of view, I have to say it didn't not bother me, but I was not that concerned about how the treatment will look. And I mean, a bit of an advertisement when you go to Burgio's site, you say we're COVID-free for I don't know how many months. So it does give you that kind of confidence, like, okay, I'm really in good hands. Mm-hmm. And all I need to concentrate on is positive will going forward. Let's try to cure this.
Oh, Naveen, it's so wonderful to hear how well you're doing.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking about health this afternoon, and we're talking about the effect of COVID-19 on cancer patients here in the UAE, joined by Naveen, who's recently come through breast cancer, and her doctor, Dr. Ibrahim Abugaida. He is the head of Department of the Radiation Oncology at Burjeel Medical City in Abu Dhabi. Anna's message then saying, I survived cancer years ago, and I can't imagine having to go through it during the pandemic. Sending love and light to Irene and Naveen. Your strength is amazing. And Tina, thinking of you, saying, I was diagnosed with breast cancer last year. My first thought was, if I died, my family wouldn't be able to visit me because of the travel restrictions. I'm still undergoing treatment, and my doctor's optimistic. Hope to see my family soon. Sorry, Dr. Ibrahim, the reason I'm getting a bit emotional is I'm actually literally just before the show today was messaging one of my best friends she has stage 4 breast cancer now in the UK. I obviously can't get back home to see her, and I'm feeling very, very, very far away from her right now. So every Tuesday, every Tuesday she goes into London to have her treatment, and she has to go on her own. And we message when she's on the train because, you know, she's got to travel alone. She can't take her husband. She can't take her mum because of COVID-19. And I just, it really breaks my heart to think of people going through treatment alone and being in situations where, especially as expats here, you know, we don't know when we can see friends and family again. And thank you to everyone who's been in touch, and, you know, Tina, who's undergoing treatment right now. I've been really trying to keep it together for the last hour, but it kind of really does hit home. So she was diagnosed, like you did, with stage 4 breast cancer last May, and it spread to her stomach and her lungs. And she's got 3 children. She's got a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old. And she thought it was mastitis, but it always turned out to be a lump. So I obviously am not dealing with it very well at all. But I just want to say that to anyone who's really struggling right now with a diagnosis, or someone who is trying to support friends and family, it's an incredibly, incredibly challenging time. And doctor, thank you for all of your hard work, working with patients and working with families, because that positive mindset it's absolutely crucial. What would you say to anyone who might have had a recent diagnosis and has the fear, or someone who's trying to support friends and family right now?
So I would say that, first of all, thank you so much for this touching.
Sorry.
You know, words you said. I feel that your agony. I see it in some patients that we see. I would say almost on a daily basis, unfortunately, and it's all about no one's alone. This is what I wanted you to know, and your friend and you becoming a close friend. No one is alone. So the treating team, we as physicians, and Naveena could also kind of pitch in here. We are family. You got to know that our job is a humanitarian job more than anything else, and we feel with the patients. So the patients should not feel that they're on their own. I know that they love the family being with them. I know, but these are kind of an exceptional times. That does not mean that they should not get their treatment. And you know, stage 4 cancer is, you know, there's a lot of lines of treatment for different types of cancer, and it's becoming more of a chronic disease.
Mm-hmm.
So I would not really I always like to give people, families, a positive energy. I don't want to call it a false hope, because it's no more false. I mean, Science and have so much advanced in the past decade or so that there's a lot of very powerful medications and drugs that can, you know, keep stage four cancer patients around us life and healthy, you know, for a long period of time. So I would always say that for every single cancer patient battling this disease, first of all, you are not on your own. Cancer is a disease that does not know a race, an age, a gender. It does not differentiate between anyone. And our job as humans, first of all, before being doctors or before being studying and going all through our examinations and certifications, we are humans at the end of the day. And we deal with you as a human being, as we like to be dealt with. So you're not on your own. Your friend is not on her own. I'm pretty sure her team is doing an incredible great job making her feel as comfortable. Our job is to keep everyone, because no one's immune. I could be a cancer patient next year. No one is immune, right? So we deal with people the way we want to be dealt with. So keep sending positive energy to everyone. You're going to do great. And we're here to support you.
Honestly, that really means a lot, because when you're far away, you never really feel like you're getting a picture of what's happening. You know, it feels very abstract. Yes. And as you say, the thought of her having a team around her when she, you know, and she travels, it really does mean a lot. And thank you. I'm just having a need to see if there's any tissues in the office in the studio somewhere. But Doctor, thank you so much for your time. And Navina, again, I'm so thrilled that you've come through this. I think you're just an absolute incredible woman, and I can't thank you enough for sharing your story today.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking about food allergies and intolerances this afternoon. It feels like they're on the rise. Are they on the rise, or just social media, more people talking about them? We'll be getting to the bottom of that with Dr. Stuart Carr. He's born and raised in Canada. He's got more than two decades of experience providing allergy and asthma services. His interests are particularly around paediatric asthma and food allergies, and he is their Chief Medical Officer at Snow Asthma and Allergy. Good afternoon, Dr. Stuart. How are you?
I'm well, Helen. How are you this afternoon?
I'm all right. Just a bit emotional, but health-wise, absolutely fine. No coughs, sneezes and diseases and all that good stuff. So we already have had a number of messages for you, sir. I think a lot of people are a bit confused about allergies and intolerances and kind of the differences. So I know this is very much your bread and butter, and you are part of all sorts of different WhatsApp groups and peer studies and all sorts of things. But we are going to go back to basics, if that's all right for us mere mortals, if you don't mind. What is the difference between a food allergy and an intolerance? Are you able to kind of put those into two quite distinct columns and areas for us?
Yeah, very much. It's an important question, because people generally think that anything sort of adverse that happens to them when they eat a food may be a sign of allergy. But food allergy very narrowly refers to any adverse reaction that's caused by your immune system. So by definition, to be an allergic response, it has to be immune mediated. And there's a couple of different kinds of that we'll see. You know, the classic immediate kind of allergic reaction that can be very severe and life-threatening, you know, your peanut allergy or shellfish allergy with hives and swelling and choking and vomiting and trouble breathing. There's also another kind of allergy that's a little less common, that's a delayed kind of allergy that causes very severe abdominal symptoms, profound, protracted, repeated vomiting and diarrhea, usually a few hours after eating. It's more common in very young infants. These are babies who have vomiting and diarrhea or bloody stools, for example, with milk formula. Or in adults, we see it with foods like shellfish, again, interestingly. Mm-hmm. And then all the other food-related problems that we have that aren't caused by the immune system are really lumped together as food intolerances. And they're really a real grab bag. Some of them we understand well, like lactose intolerance, which is a sort of a normal state as we get older, a relative inability to digest the milk sugar part, as opposed to allergies, which are caused by the protein part. But then many, many other sort of food-related issues are loosely called intolerances, but we really don't understand most of them very well.
That's interesting, because we're going to be talking about testing soon as well. So if anyone's got any... Well, if you've been advised by your doctor to go for intolerance testing, you might want to stay with us because we'll be unpicking that as well. So let's start with allergies, if you don't mind, Dr. Carter. You know, what do we know about causes? Because having done minimal research compared to your decades, there are several reports suggesting there could be a link between food allergies and babies born by cesarean section because they're not emerging through the birth canal and getting the useful bacteria there. In Denmark, it was even proved that the more cats and dogs you have, the less likely you are to have an allergic disorder. What about causation when it comes to food allergies in particular?
Yeah, another really good question. And look, we're learning a lot about sort of the root causes of a lot of allergic conditions. And you touched on a couple of things that impact it. We do know that there's an increased risk of developing food and environmental allergies if you're born by cesarean section. We think this has to do with the gut microbiome, the way that your gut is colonized with bacteria. And it's a different exposure when you pass through the birth canal than when you're born by C-section. But ultimately, what seems to be the most important cause of food allergy is having severe eczema. If you've got severe, moderate to severe atopic dermatitis, the, you know, quote unquote allergic kind of eczema, that genetic inherited defect in skin barrier function seems to be the most important starting point for causing food allergy. And that's interesting because years ago, people used to worry that eczema was being caused by food allergy. Mm. And now we know quite the opposite is true, that eczema causes food allergy instead.
That is really interesting. And it seems like, you know, attitudes and even technologies around allergies have changed enormously in the last decade. What have been some notable changes that you think have been really, really positive?
Yeah, I think the biggest things that we're seeing, especially over the last decade, I think that timeline is really, really clever, is that we now understand that early introduction to highly allergenic foods like egg and peanut in babies, especially babies at increased risk with eczema or a strong family history of allergy, significantly decreases the risk of developing allergy. And that's a 180 degree turn from where we were, you know, two decades ago. We were routinely and frankly erroneously recommending the delayed introduction of a lot of these foods with the hope that we could sort of bypass this window where babies seem to become more likely to be allergic. And unfortunately, that led to a significant increase in the rates of allergies for peanuts, a doubling in peanut allergy in the population, and increases in food allergy across the board. And now we know that early exposure to food allergens instead is protective and can decrease the risk of developing, for example, peanut allergy by between 70 and 85%. And there's very few things in medicine that we can impact the risk of by that kind of magnitude. We also now know that in those kids who still go on to develop food allergy despite our best efforts to prevent it, we now have therapies to try to turn off food allergy or at least decrease the risk of having severe reactions.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So many of you getting in touch with your questions and queries around allergies and intolerances. We've got Dr. Stuart Carr with us. He's an allergist and clinical immunologist. No, how do you say it, Dr. Carr?
Immunologist.
Thank you so much. You're from Canada, but here in the UAE as Chief Medical Officer at Snow Asthma and Allergy. Going to the text line, you're a very popular man. Elisa wants to know, as an adult, how can I isolate what I'm allergic to, whether it is food or creams or makeup? Good question indeed. I think a lot of us want answers. We know we all want to be analysed. We want to have that information and be able to kind of move through life safely and knowing what's on hand if something does happen. Is there a way of accurately diagnosing an allergy?
Absolutely. So for food allergy, the main issue is the history, the story. And really, food allergy is never subtle. Food allergies are usually very apparent. Patients have immediate symptoms with food allergies, again, with a few very unique exceptions that have a very typical history. But I always say to patients that if somebody says to me, "Doc, I'm worried I have a food allergy," I always say, "Okay, that's fine. What food are you worried about?" And if they say, "I don't know, that's why I'm here," I say, "Good, then you don't have a food allergy." Food allergies cause rapid, obvious symptoms. And after one or two episodes, the person knows to avoid that food. They're already avoiding it by the time I see them. And if they aren't certain of a food allergy, then that alone is largely proof. So the best test for food allergy is what happens when you eat the food. And if you're eating the food without any obvious, reproducible, consistent symptoms, if you're eating the food in different forms, you know, for example, somebody with a milk allergy can't eat cheese or yogurt or ice cream without having a reaction. The proteins are the same. So the best test is what happens when you eat the food. If somebody has had a concerning enough story that we're unable to do the best test, then there are skin and blood tests that can help us. But those have to be based on the clinical history.
Okay.
Now, for the other things that the caller raised, creams, makeup products, that's a different kind of allergy. Those can certainly cause what's called an allergic contact dermatitis. And, you know, the classic form of that is something like a poison ivy rash or the metal allergy that lots of people suffer with if they wear, things with nickel or cadmium or chromium in them. And makeups, other skincare products, soaps, shampoos can cause allergic contact dermatitis in some people. And the best test to confirm that, because that can be a lot trickier than a food allergy, is something called a patch test. And that's usually done with a dermatologist. And what they do is they put these common sensitizing chemicals basically on your back for 2 days and see whether it causes a localized reaction that suggests that you have again this allergic contact dermatitis. So there are ways to test for those sort of products. Then they can give you a list, if you're allergic to chemical X or chemical Y or Z or product like, again, metals like nickel, what things you should avoid direct skin contact with. Those kind of allergies don't cause life-threatening reactions, but they can be very unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. Good. That makes a lot of sense indeed. Lots of people getting in touch with some symptoms. Farhad says, when I have dairy, usually a glass of milk or yogurt, not so much with cheese, I get mucus at the back of my throat. Sometimes get bloated. Does this mean I need to cut it out completely?
Yeah, so, you know, those are very common symptoms. So the first part, there's two kind of separate parts there. The first part, the mucus feeling in the back of the throat is actually really common. And for years, there's been a common misconception that milk or dairy products increase mucus production. You know, milk makes mucus. And people have been advised if they have allergic rhinitis or even with the common cold that they should avoid dairy products because of milk making more mucus. It turns out that's not true. Milk doesn't increase mucus production. It turns out that the texture of products like milk and yogurt being a little bit thicker makes you more aware of the mucus that you already have.
It's a brain thing, not a snot thing.
Exactly. And so that thicker texture, you know, you then notice the mucus that you've got and it makes you, you know, maybe clear your throat a little bit more, but it doesn't actually cause a problem, and avoiding it won't make you any healthier. You know, if somebody's really bothered by that sensation, then they may want to avoid textures like that. But it's been shown that even milk substitutes like soy milk that have a similar texture will cause the same sort of feeling.
Love
the bloating suggests that it could be a lactose intolerance, which again is actually the normal state as we get older. So really what that depends on is how big of a problem it is. If it's a minor problem, the person can kind of bear with it. Again, it's not going to adversely affect their health. It's just a nuisance problem. But if it's causing them a lot of cramping or diarrhea, then they're probably going to choose to either avoid dairy or take lactose-free dairy products.
There you go, Farhad. I don't like this implication of us getting older and becoming less I am getting less tolerant to everything as I get older, but I certainly hope that dairy's not going to fall into that category.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Taking your questions, Dr. Stuart Carr, allergist and clinical immunologist here in the UAE as Chief Medical Officer at Snow Allergy and Asthma. A question from Sana, Dr. Carr, saying my kids, age 9 and 6, and my husband have a casein intolerance and struggle with food options, mostly dairy. Should they be taking vitamin D or any other vitamins regularly? Can you shed any light?
Yeah, and so casein is one of the milk proteins. You know, if you think back to Little Miss Muffet and her curds and whey, it's the curds or harder part of the milk protein, and it is a common food allergen. It's a difficult one. Obviously, dairy is an important part of our diet, so it does limit our choices a lot. It makes it harder to navigate when you're trying to eat out in restaurants, etc. But the most important thing that you'll miss out on if you're avoiding dairy products is calcium and vitamin D. Calcium especially. Calcium is quite hard to get in your diet from sources other than dairy products. You know, there's a few other calcium-rich foods, but even those you have to eat massive quantities of. So we really emphasize the importance of getting adequate supplementation of calcium and vitamin D in people who have to avoid dairy products.
Thank you. Really hope that helps Susanna and your family. Now, Dr. Carr, we are hearing more and more about allergies. Is this because of the internet, increased awareness leading to more diagnosis, or is the number of sufferers actually on the rise? What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, it probably is a bit of both. I mean, we certainly are more plugged in and connected around the globe. So, you know, we hear about things, you know, if somebody happens to, for example, have an unfortunate bad allergic reaction, most of us in the allergy world know about these fortunately rare events quite quickly. But we do know that, as I was talking about earlier, that allergies have increased, and food allergies in particular have doubled. Now, we're still not talking about a huge percentage of the population. Some studies would say between maybe 5% and 8% of the population having either the immediate or delayed type of food allergy. You know, and if you look at individual foods, peanut is one of the more common foods affecting around between 1% and 2% of the population. So still a small minority, but yeah, it has increased. We're hoping now with our changed approach to early introduction that we're gonna modify that in the long term, and we'll see less food allergy in the future.
Dr. Carr, a study out of the US showed that 3 to 4 times as many people think they have a food allergy than actually do. You're nodding on Microsoft Teams. Does that sound
yes.
about right?
In fact, that might even be a low estimate. One study a few years ago showed that about 1 in 4 people thought that they had a food allergy, when in fact, at that time, it was less than 1 in 20 in the general population. So, you know, it may be even 5 or 6 times. So that's a really common phenomenon that people think they have a food allergy or report a food allergy. And again, there's the difference with food intolerances. Lots of people, for example, with a lactose intolerance will reported as a milk allergy. I've seen people worried about getting the coronavirus vaccine because they think they have a milk allergy when in fact they probably have a lactose intolerance and should never have been worrying about it in the first place.
I wanted to ask you about, well, I'm basically going to kind of lump quite a few questions in together, if that's okay. We've had questions about growing out of allergies and kind of even developing intolerances and allergies later in life. So can you talk us through kind of the lifespan? When do, let's talk about allergies in particular, tend to display, you know, when do we see them in the body?
Yeah, so allergies can develop at any age, but most food allergies do develop in very early childhood. So, you know, we will see the majority of these showing themselves before school age for sure, and usually in the infant and toddler years. But again, you know, we will very occasionally see somebody pop up with a food allergy later in life. It's often to foods that are not as common in the diet, because if we're eating a food on a regular basis, it makes it much less likely for your immune system to sort of turn against it. As far as outgrowing allergies, luckily that's also fairly common. If you look at a food like milk or egg, you know, depending on the data set you look at, between sort of 50 and 80% of kids will outgrow those allergies over time. And we now have strategies for helping them push them towards tolerance. With other foods like peanuts or nut allergies, their chance of outgrowing it naturally is a little bit lower. It may only be 15 to 20%, but you know, it's not zero. And so these are things that need to be reassessed over time. And again, since our approaches change, even somebody who's had a long-standing allergy, it's always worth revisiting it, because we may have options now that we didn't have 5 or 10 years ago.
Mona wants to know, can food intolerances trigger migraines?
Yeah, so this would not be an allergic or immune-mediated process, but I think it's been fairly well shown that some people with migraines will have dietary triggers. The problem, and this now goes into the larger area of food intolerances in general, is that for most of these, there isn't a test. There's no simple blood test or skin test or any other simple test that's going to identify, for example, migraine triggers. That's just going to take detective work. So that kind of problem, we would encourage a person to keep a diary where they write down the foods that they're eating and drinking on an ongoing basis, and then make note of when they get migraines, maybe the severity or duration of them, so that they can then look back to see if they can identify any consistent pattern. And, you know, we all tend to have a bit of recall bias. So if we get a headache or a stomach ache, we think, oh, what did I eat? And we may blame that, but we don't necessarily realize that we ate the same food many other times without trouble. And that's where a diary can provide invaluable information. It's a little more work, but it's really the only way to get to the bottom of most food intolerances.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
But discussing the immune system with immunologist Dr. Stuart Carr, he also has a special interest when it comes to pediatric asthma. So we're talking food intolerances and allergies too. We are going to get through as many questions as possible in a last minute rush, Dr. Carr. So we're going to go quick. Carl,
let's quickly caffeinate.
Carl has read there's good evidence that more antibiotics someone is given as a child, the more likely they are to have a food allergy. Those antibiotics kill the healthy bacteria that colonize the gut. What is your opinion on this, Dr. Carr?
Yeah, I think he's quite right. There is growing evidence that early exposure to antibiotics, especially, you know, in the very early newborn period or in the first year of life, does appear to increase the risk of both developing food allergy and probably asthma. So it's really important that we make sure that we're using antibiotics judiciously and not haphazardly, for sure.
And also speaking to doctors about what you can do after a course of antibiotics to replace that good gut bacteria. Noah's been in touch saying, my three-year-old son has had eczema since he was 3 months old. Once he started solids, we noticed there were many foods he had the reaction to or that flared up as eczema. Milk products, eggs, severe instant hive breakout caused by nuts, avocado, sesame seeds. To top it off, he's a very picky eater, which really leaves us with nothing but grains in his diet. Is there a way out of food allergies? Is his food palate always going to stay limited, or is there hope for us? Oh, desperate sounding parent there. Sounds really, really difficult. What would you advise here? This is a three-year-old boy.
Right. So, I mean, this is a very, you know, unfortunate, but frankly, fairly typical kind of case that we see. I mentioned earlier that eczema, and especially more moderate to severe eczema, may be the main cause of food allergy. And it sounds like that's the circumstance here. I think first, again, it's always worth reassessing at that age that the child may have outgrown allergies to things like milk and egg. But there's also a lot of kids with allergies to milk and egg that will tolerate them in extensively heated forms, muffins, cakes, cookies, that are thoroughly cooked in the oven. And so we have ways of either challenging that or starting something called the milk or egg ladder, which gradually introduces these foods in allergic children and may act as a form of modified immunotherapy. For things like nuts and seeds, at that age, as a toddler, they're an excellent age to consider oral immunotherapy, which is a really promising treatment that we've talked about before that may turn off the food allergy in some cases, but at the very least protect them against severe reactions from accidental exposure. So there are lots of options. You know, they mentioned being a fussy eater. That raises some other possibilities. We see a problem called eosinophilic esophagitis, which can affect some young children with food allergies and makes it hard for them to swallow certain foods. You know, so there's a lot to explore in a case like that, but boy, it sure sounds like they would benefit from a more thorough assessment.
Okay, especially at age three, as you say, a lot of these things displaying very, very early on. In fact, this message from Samia saying, my 11-month-old daughter has a terrible flare-up of eczema whenever I try to introduce yogurt. I'm struggling how to help her with introducing cow's milk because I'm worried she might miss out on nutrients needed. How can I supplement and how can I make sure her food-induced eczema flare-ups are under control? So going back to exactly what we're talking about, flipping that idea, what would you advise to Samia and her little girl?
Yeah, so the number one thing there is sometimes eczema will flare up and it may look like it's being flared up by a food you're eating, but it may not be. It may just be the normal ups and downs of eczema. So step one always, before we even think about potential dietary triggers, is always making sure the eczema is well managed, a good, thorough treatment plan to keep the eczema as well controlled as we can. And then in a case like that, we'd want to see if there is any evidence of a milk allergy, if it's been a consistent finding with different dairy products like yogurt and maybe others. And then if it does turn out to be a milk allergy, that would be a perfect child to start on a milk ladder again, which is starting with really small amounts of very extensively heated milk, again, in baked goods, and gradually increasing that as tolerated. That's shown tremendous success in young children with a milk allergy.
I love this. I love a doctor that prescribes muffins and cookies. This is my my kind of prescription. And this message, I wanted to end on this one because I'm sure you've got some thoughts and have had spoken to many peers about this. An existential question has come in. What causes allergies in humans, keeping our history and ancestors in mind? Any theories from you, Dr. Stuart Carr?
You know, it's a really great question, and it is something that's a bit of a puzzle because it's not really clear that allergies themselves offer any very particular or beneficial evolutionary advantage.
What purpose do they serve? I've got no idea.
Yeah, I mean, the arm of the immune system that's responsible for allergies, which we broadly call the Th2 immune response, and it's the part that's responsible for fighting against parasites and certain other very specific infections. It may also have a role in cancer surveillance. So, I mean, it does offer some function, and probably historically, when parasites were more endemic, it probably did offer a significant survival advantage. It's one of the reasons we think that we see more allergy in children who are born in sort of a westernized country that has a very low rate of parasites, mm-hmm. but the family has immigrated from a place with a higher rate of endemic parasitic infections. And, you know, back home, we would see this a lot with immigrants from the Philippines, where the family did not necessarily have a strong history of allergy, but the children that were born in Canada would end up with multiple allergies. And this has been shown in certain immigrant populations in a few other parts of the world as well. So, I mean, in a short answer is, you know, we don't have all the answers for that, but we do think that it probably has to do, at least to some degree, with protection against parasites.
Dr. Stuart Carr, thank you so much for all of your no-nonsense advice and insights this afternoon. It's always an absolute pleasure. Apologies to anyone whose message we couldn't get to. You were very, very popular this hour. And as I said, if anyone wants to contact you directly, you can be found at Snow Asthma and Allergy in our nation's fair capital. Wishing you and yours all the very best for the afternoon and evening ahead, Dr. Stuart Carr.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is your psychology hour, and it's all about trolling and what we've come to know now as cancel culture. For many, sorry isn't enough. Now, American model, endorser, and a social media star Chrissy Teigen has been cancelled. Why? Because she's recently been outed as a troll. She's lost a number of endorsements because of it. She sent out a lengthy apology recently, but many people still not convinced. Joining us live is Dr. Thrive from the Human Relations Institute Clinic, where she's a clinical psychologist. So here's the story. Chrissy Teigen broke a month-long social media silence to apologise for bullying several people on Twitter. In a post, she said she regretted the crushing weight of regret for the things she said in the past. She published a series of tweets in May apologising to TV personality Courtney Stodden, who accused her of online bullying. The apology was accepted by Stodden, who said it could just be an attempt to limit the damage done to Teigen's reputation. In her latest post, she said she was privately reaching out to people she'd insulted, though she didn't say who, simply saying, "There is no excuse for my past horrible tweets. I was a troll, full stop. I am sorry." She recently posted about Father's Day. People are not buying it. Why do people troll? That's what we're talking about this afternoon. And why sometimes apologies are simply not enough. Dr. Thraya, how are you, my dear?
I'm well. How are you, Helen?
I am all right. Thank you very much. I mean, it feels like this cancel culture is something of a recent phenomenon. Certainly we've got a name for it. Can you explain mm-hmm. to anyone who's not familiar with the term what it is in kind of in general terms?
So cancel culture is basically this idea of completely shutting out someone who makes a mistake from your perception. So, for instance, what's happening with Chrissy Teigen is exactly that. So individuals either the endorsement agencies have stopped working with her, or people have started unfollowing her and so on and so forth when she's been outed that she was a troll, or when she actually came out and apologized for being a troll. So this is essentially what cancel culture is about. It's about shutting someone completely out after realizing that they've made a mistake.
I think the trolling thing is particularly interesting when it's a celebrity, because a lot of people hide behind aliases, behind an avatar, behind their keyboard. It's essentially bullying. Trolls can be cowards a lot of the time, as I said, using anonymity to say what they want to say, or even saying things to kind of poke the bear and get a reaction to get attention themselves. Most trolls right. aren't famous, won't reveal themselves, and this is perhaps why Teigen was forced to say sorry, because she was outed. What do we know about the psychology of trolling? What is that? Does it come back to just a more sophisticated tech way of schoolyard bullying, or is it a completely different kettle of fish?
Well, you know, if you want to look at it from a simplistic perspective, it's exactly that. However, because of technology, because of how widespread our information, our opinions can be right now, what ends up happening is that you can do a lot more damage than just, you know, schoolyard bullying. So what ends up happening with trolling is that individuals will actually seek out other individuals that they could bully and treat or speak to in a very mean manner, and they can say incorrect things about them and so on and so forth. And so with trolling, what we usually find is that the individual, just like with bullying, the bully themselves is, you know, experiences low self-esteem, is not very self-confident, usually is a victim of being bullied or trolled themselves, and has a lot of emotional dysregulation, and they don't know how to deal with that, so they take it out on a completely different person. And essentially, that's what a troll is just an online bully.
When it comes to people coming into clinic, social media pressures are real, whether you are a teen at school wanting likes, wanting, you know, validation from your classmates, all the way through to people that have got tens of millions of followers. What impact do you think negativity on social media is having amongst, you know, us civilians here in the UAE?
I think quite significantly. I mean, I see so many people that continue to believe social media in it's correct and it's accurate. It's an accurate representation of a person's life, which we know very well, Helen. It's not exact. And actually, I love your posts when you actually sit there and you're like, this is my reality, you know, after all the really great posts that I put up there. But this is also my reality.
Here, and I think that's watching, so important. Holy moly, having a bowl of cereal because I can't be bothered to cook. Yeah, okay.
No, but it's so important, and I am so happy to see you do that, because it's really important that people take their responsibility of being influencers and so popular on social media in the right way. They have to understand that they are really showing individuals an incorrect representation unless they do what you're doing. And that's why it's very important. And unfortunately, people take that incorrect representation and then they start to say things like, oh, I wish I had that life, or I wish I was like this person. And they don't actually see what's behind the screen.
Mm-hmm. Or in some cases, as we've seen, it flips into jealousy, and then that becomes, you know, celebrities or is, you know, even classmates being the source of anger and insults and ultimately bullying or trolling, as we're talking about today. An interesting study came out just recently saying that social media posts are twice as likely to go viral if they're negative. So this is specifically talking about politicians. So if you are basically, 2.7 million tweets were analysed, Facebook posts from US media outlets about political figures over 5 years. The negative posts were twice as likely to be commented on. They attracted more angry or laughing emoji reactions on Facebook than positive, you know, hearts or thumbs up. I think is you know, are you surprised by that? We always talk about the negativity bias.
Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not. If you really think about it, you know, even as children, we learn that, you know, we do something good, we get like a pat on the back or a good job. But if we do something bad, we get the whole shebang. We get the, why did you do that? Didn't I tell you not to do that? And so on and so forth. So essentially, what we learn as children, that negative attention is always better than positive attention, because of the fact that we actually get more attention through negative things than we do through positivity. This is unfortunately the trend and the pattern that has happened so many times. And you see it so much more in social media. As soon as someone says something incorrect or says something negative, what ends up happening is that everybody finds out about them, right?
Yeah.
And the whole world starts to know who this person is. Whereas before, if they had posted nice things, maybe like a maximum of 100, 200 people may have known who they were.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've read the book by John Ronson. It's called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And it's absolutely fascinating. And it talks about lots of different people who have been publicly shamed, people who had never been heard of until they made what might seem to be a mistake on social media or said something that went against, you know, the kind of common consensus. It's absolutely brilliant. We're going to grab a clip of that very soon.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking trolling and cancel culture with Dr. Thuraya, clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Can I ask, if someone has been trolled, and it could be on that, you know, grand scale, as you mentioned, that kind of Twitter pylon by saying something unpopular, or it could be someone that you know maybe hiding behind an alias on your Instagram DMs. What do you think is the best way to react to protect your mental health, Dr. Thuraya?
Well, I think one of the best things to do is to first, I mean, obviously it depends on how many people are trolling you at the same time, right? But if you have that one individual, let's say it's important to set a very strong boundary and tell them that if they continue to speak to you in this manner, then you will block them. And if they do, then to automatically block them. Now, if unfortunately you happen to be trolled by many individuals, maybe it's time to take a little bit of a break from social media to just give yourself the opportunity to regroup and to see what you want to do in a calmer manner before you react. So do not engage. This is one of the first things that I tell people when they are being, you know, bullied either online or offline. Say do not engage, set a boundary, but do not engage. Don't try to, you know, have a proper conversation with them. Don't try to explain your side or explain your point of view, because that's not really why they're there. They're really there just to so make true. You feel bad.
And not there to try and learn from you or have any kind of debate.
Right.
Now, I want to come back to the Chrissy Teigen incident, because as I said, a number of years ago, she'd basically trolled someone else, a number of people, including a TV personality. She recently came out with this very long apology, and it's been greeted with some people thinking, great, fantastic, you know, she's come out, she's owning up to her past mistakes. Other people, a bit of eye rolling, saying she's trying to protect her, you know, commercial relationships and endorsements. When do you feel like forgiveness is necessary? You know, we're talking about cancel culture here. When it comes to celebrities, we've seen some people being very, very permanently cancelled. How do we know when an apology is sincere, Dr. Thuraya, do you think?
Well, I think one of the most important things to notice is whether or not the person's actually taking responsibility for their actions, or if they're making excuses and coming up with reasons. And even if they have valid reasons, even if they have, you know, valid concerns on what was going on, but still, it's important to still take responsibility for what they did. I think it's also to recognize why that person is apologizing. I mean, I know it's really difficult from a celebrity perspective that you have so many people that are looking at what you're doing, and you make one mistake. And even if you are sincerely apologizing, most people are like, oh, she's just doing it, or he's just doing it for, you know, so other people don't cancel them out and so on and so forth, or for this endorsement or for that endorsement. But in reality, it could really be a sincere apology. And I think it's important to recognize that if you have somebody that's just apologizing for the sake of apologizing, that's when you don't really want to take that on board just yet. Mm-hmm. But look at the apology. The apology is quite detailed. She's really introspective and very reflective. And yes, I know there are going to be some people that are going to be like, yes, she probably has a really good publicist or somebody who's giving her very good tips on how to. But sometimes we have to give people the benefit of the doubt, especially since the behavior is not repetitive till now. Mm-hmm. So this was a period in her life that she behaved like this. And then she stopped before anybody even knew that she was doing this. She had stopped. And since then, she has not been doing that same behavior. And I think that's something to look at, because we all make mistakes. And sometimes we are in a period of our life where we're just horrible people. And it's important that we grow from that. And as long as we are growing and we are admitting and taking responsibility and accountability for what we've done, I think that's where people need to take that on board and be like, you know what, let's give her another chance.
Dr. Thrive, putting celebrities aside, what do you think are some of the signs of a sincere apology for us mere mortals? If we have done something atrocious, it could be online, it could be in person. You know, what are some of, and even language use, and I'm not asking you to write an apology, but so people really know that you mean it. And I know you can write from the heart, but there can be some red flags where people go, I feel like, you know, you're just saying that I'm sorry that you got upset is not an apology.
No, it's not. Or I'm sorry you felt that way. Or I'm sorry that happened. These are very vague statements. So sometimes the word I'm sorry doesn't really need to be said. Sometimes it's like, you know, I realize that I crossed the line. I realize that I did something that was really, that really hurt you. And I realize that this should not occur again. And I will try my best. So these are very detailed descriptions of what happened, the responsibility that the person had in that matter, and what they plan on doing moving forward. If you just get an apology that's kind of like, I'm sorry this happened, or I'm sorry I did that, that's not good enough. That's really just the person saying it for the sake of saying it. And you'll hear it because it sounds very much like a teenager when they're kind of apologizing to their parents when they get caught. It's like, yeah, okay, I'm sorry I did that. You know, it's kind of one
I'm
of those.
Sorry I got
so
caught.
Whenever you,
yeah.
Or I'm sorry I got caught. So whenever you hear something that sounds like it's not genuine from the perspective of it's not detailed enough, not really thought out, it's just being said for the sake of ending the conversation or avoiding the confrontation or in hopes to make the other person feel better. And this is where you want to kind of sit down and be like, look, this is not an apology that you kind of thought through. If you want, try again, and then we'll discuss it again. But this is not an apology that I can accept.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking trolling and cancel culture with Dr. Thrive, clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. In many ways, it is great that we can call out so-called bad behaviour on social media. But are we cancelling everyone for every single thing? What can and cannot be forgiven? Let us know if there's been any celebrities that you have decided to unfollow or simply stop engaging in, maybe stop buying their music, not watch their films, not buy their cookbooks. Very interested to find out what the tipping point would be for you. Adrian's been in touch saying, I recently came off Twitter because I'm sick to death of so many innocuous posts being dissected, taken out of context, unpicked and twisted, etc., resulting in baying mobs declaring a particular person is now cancelled. No debate, no discussion, just cancelled. Active discussion seems to be almost discouraged sometimes, and hordes of people have one giant toddler tantrum to declare that someone is finished, done. Surely that isn't a good thing. Dr. Thrive, I think that is actually a really interesting point from Adrian there. Are we perhaps too easily offended these days?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think the newer generations and even some of the older generations are, I think we forgot how to take things lightly. Mm-hmm. Everyone is just, you know, offended at everything. And they forget that, you know, people come from different cultures. People come from different places. They come from different backgrounds. So not everybody understands things in the same way. Not everybody communicates in the same way. And instead of just canceling people out or automatically becoming offended, learn how to communicate and sort of say, wait, this is what I understood from what you said. Is this what you meant? So that you give the person an opportunity to correct whether or not that's actually what they said or what they meant. Mm-hmm. And I think we have this this new tendency to just not put in any amount of effort in properly communicating and effectively communicating with other people. We're just like, you know what? It's easier to either walk away from them, to escape from them, to ghost them, all of this stuff. It's just, it's becoming quite horrible to see from like in a progressive way for myself. I mean, I've been working in this field for over 15 years now. So where it was and where it is today, it's quite different.
Super, super black and white. My genuine question, I really, really do mean this. Where do people find the time? Where do people find the time to be looking through Twitter or following people that give them no kind of sense of joy and just seem to get a massive kick out of being unpleasant? I really just do something a bit more productive with yourself. I genuinely don't get it.
I think that's perfect, Helen. Really, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's really about the person not being fulfilled in their life, because for those that do find fulfillment in their own lives, they don't have nor waste the time on finding other people to hurt and troll and be offended by. And, you know, like they find fulfillment and peace within themselves. And that's all that matters. But unfortunately, what you'll find is that the individuals that are trolling, that are bullying, that are looking for people to offend them and thus respond, you know, reactively, I think they're empty. They're finding emptiness in their life and they're looking to fill it somehow.
Dr. Thoreau, I mentioned earlier a book by John Ronson. He's an incredible journalist and author, and he wrote a book called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And he looked at some very specific circumstances and individuals who had been publicly shamed. It's probably about 5 or so years old now. So talked a lot about Twitter. And here he is talking about it.
But the phrase misuse of privilege is becoming a free pass to tear apart pretty much anybody we choose to. It's becoming a devalued term, and it's making us lose our capacity for empathy and for distinguishing between serious and unserious transgressions.
Losing empathy. So having a quick look at celebrities that have been so-called cancelled. Ellen DeGeneres cancelled after several allegations she fostered a toxic workplace culture. Anna Wintour cancelled after people called her out for her history of not supporting or elevating black content creators and employees. Hilaria Baldwin, I have to say I find this one quite funny, was recently cancelled after she was accused of pretending to be Spanish. I don't know why. Lea Michele was cancelled after Glee actor Samantha Marie Ware recounted microaggressions to her on set. Kirstie Alley cancelled after criticising the Oscars diversity initiative and for being a Donald Trump supporter. Now, what I would say is that when we're talking about crime, whether that is sexual assault or misconduct, I think it's absolutely fine. There are some people that I won't watch their shows anymore. Regrettably, one particular music artist that I really did enjoy his music, and I now can't enjoy it in the same way. So when there is a crime as such, I think it's very different to someone perhaps expressing an opinion that you simply don't agree with. Dr. Thoreau, thank you as ever for being with us today. What's keeping you busy in clinic right now? What's hot in the world of the clinic?
You mean in terms of
people coming in,
things that are coming in? I would say stress. Stress is a big one. Concerns of COVID, especially because, you know, numbers are starting to go up again, and anxiety. Those are the big ones.
I wish I could say I'm surprised, but I'm not. I think a lot of people, myself included, are just feeling a little bit over it, mega fatigued. And, you know, we've spoken about this before, but, you know, many people, of course, being expats here in the UAE and job concerns, wanting to have a holiday to see friends and family and simply not having that in the diary. It does get you down. It really does.
It leads to burnout. I mean, people are just tired. They just want a break.
Did you see, we're going to talk about this next week, but just quickly, dating app Bumble has given all of their employees a week off. Because of burnout.
Yes.
Absolutely fascinating. Yes. And do you know what? I get it, because when you do take a break, part of your brain is going, I mean, this is nice, but I'm going to go back to an absolute deluge of emails because everyone else is still working. But if the whole company's put on a week's leave, I think we could get on board with this. What do you reckon?
I think that's a great idea.
Okay. It's been doctor approved. People of the UAE, we're all going to have a week's holiday, and I forbid you to send a single email. Dr. Thoreau, thank you so, so much for your time.
Thank you, Helen.
A pleasure. We'll catch up next week.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.